Always on 24/7 Limitless Possibility FM. This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Mangan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeble.
And our subject today is...
Do I really need to say that what will be our subject this week?
The Worldwide Dad Joke Conference.
That's a nice one. So yes, this week we'll speak about WWDC.
Awesome. But first, I have a little bit of follow-up. Last week, as you know, we talked about E3, and E3 is ongoing right now in Los Angeles. And we had a little bit of follow-up on VR. So first of all, friend of the show, David Ashby, suggested that Gone Home is basically the perfect VR game. Last week, I sort of touched a little bit on it, but I didn't name the game explicitly. VR is very well suited for storytelling experiences, and Gone Home, one of the criticisms you could have about the game is that it is essentially just a storytelling experience and not much else in terms of a game. For some people, that's fine. I mean, I know that Gone Home is received very, very well in the indie gaming community and that it is incredibly popular with that kind of people. Personally, that's not what I look for in a gaming experience, which is why I'm not very excited about the prospect of games like Gone Home on VR. But yes, I agree. It is incredibly well suited for VR headsets. And anyone who is more interested in hearing more about Gone Home or about the quote-unquote walking simulator genre should listen to an episode of one of my new favorite gaming podcasts, which is Rental Circulation by a bunch of anime heads on Twitter. And I'll put a link in the show notes to that specific episode. Next up, this just came out right before we started recording. So breaking news, Reggie Fils-Aimé from Nintendo, who is the SVP marketing or something to that effect, said that current VR doesn't work because it's not fun or social enough. And of course, the internet being what it is, took their quote entirely out of context and turned it into Reggie says VR is not fun, which is not what he said. But that's how everyone is interpreting it. And so that happened right before we started recording, and I found it quite amusing. There's other VR-related news that came out of E3, namely that Oculus has teamed up with Xbox One. So Xbox One will be capable of streaming games to the Oculus, which is interesting. Also, Oculus will come bundled with an Xbox One controller, not the new $150 Elite controller that they announced during E3, which is a whole other thing to talk about, but instead the standard Xbox One controller, which, to be honest, is a fairly good controller. Both PlayStation and Xbox really had great controllers this generation. But that's not all. Somehow Xbox One also teamed up with Valve VR, and this is the confusing bit. I'm not too sure why they did, but both Valve VR and Oculus Rift will be supported in some nature with the Xbox One. So it's really interesting because we were talking about how Sony has their own Morpheus and that everything else depended on a gaming PC. Well, now that's not the case anymore. Sony has Morpheus, and everything else will work on either a gaming PC or an Xbox One. So the proposition of an Xbox One for people who are curious about VR just got a lot better. And presumably games that are compiled for either Valve VR or Oculus SDKs will work on the Xbox One because the Xbox One is running a stealth build of Windows under it. Good job, Microsoft, on that front. I don't want to get too far into any other E3 news. So that's about it for my follow-up.
Okay, that's good. And I would like to mention that my follow-up is coming during the episode. So obviously, I know that I do have tons of stuff to say about WWDC, and my follow-up is kind of related with what Apple announced during the week. So I guess right now that Yannick is done with his follow-up, let's jump into the WWDC topic. So first, before we go into all of the session, keynote news, which we won't touch that much on it. I'm sure most of you have either A, watched the keynote, or B, read all of the news written on the internet about it. So what I like to do first is talk about my first experience to be in San Francisco during the WWDC week. And after that, we'll talk about what interests us in what was announced, and maybe some stuff that was announced more during the week than just during the first day, which includes the keynote and the State of the Union. So I'll start with my week. So when I came back, obviously when I came back from work, and obviously when I came back, Yannick asked me tons of questions. Oh, I liked my week and blah, blah, blah. And every time somebody asked me how my week in San Francisco was, it, I just answered them. It was overwhelming. Like, I think I'm still feeling overwhelmed about that week. And it's, I came back like nearly a week ago. Like, I came back last Saturday, and we're now recording on Thursday, June the 18th. So, yeah, it's like a fun time to be in San Francisco. I was like, people always tell you, like, it's the right time to be in San Francisco because everybody in the Mac and iOS community is in San Francisco. But when you are in the city, it's just jarring. It's like, wow. And yeah, it's like I just said, it was my first time attending WWDC, and I was kind of expecting that event to be big because like there's 5,000 attendees, nearly 6,000 attendees, depending on which year and how Apple is generous with tickets. And you know what? Like, everybody told me, like, you'll see big queues to go to the session and all the tralala for waiting because there's 5,000 people around you. It felt so big when you're in it, not just like hearing stories about it. So, but like, I guess it's a good plus for Apple, and at the same time, a big disadvantage because something that didn't like, let's start with the bad stuff, which I don't have that much. Obviously you do have to queue a lot. Like, there's lots of queue, and this year there was only 4 tracks, which was a little bit surprising to me, but I didn't realize it at first. It's more when I start to speak to colleagues and friends, they told me, like, hey, remember, like, in the last few years, there were about 5 to 6, 7 rooms where there was session during the week. I was like, yeah. Oh, really? So I guess the main theme of this year was just like a slow year. It's not a bad year, just slow. There was like the session was a little bit shorter. Most of them were 40 minutes compared to 1 hour. There were only rare ones that were 1 hour. And obviously, like I just said, like 4 tracks compared to like 6 to 7. So, but even then it felt pretty energizing to be in the room and to just enjoy WWDC.
Just on the topic of the sessions, I know that relative to past years, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, they've done a really, really great job of consolidating iOS and OS X core foundation, well, not core foundation because that actually means something in the development word, but, you know, the core of the OS, which is common to both of them, they really just merge those sessions together in a really great way, whereas in the first couple years of iOS in parallel with OS X, there were often duplicate sessions, one for iOS, one for OS X, and you were just like, why aren't you merging these two together? So they've gotten really good about that. And another thing that I noticed is specifically last year and the year before, there were a lot of game-specific and web-specific sessions, because for some reason WWDC has a bunch of web development sessions, and it's never really clear why they're there, because ostensibly no one is there for web development-related stuff, unlike Google I.O. And this year, I think they pared down a lot of the web ones, and I feel like there was less gaming-related stuff as well this year.
To be honest, though, I feel that they pared down most of the topics this year. So I guess it's more like related to the fact that there's less stuff to announce and less new shiny stuff to try on either the gaming side, the normal app development side, or on the web development side, to be honest.
Well, like, I don't think that's necessarily accurate for gaming, because gaming actually had quite a bit of new APIs introduced this year. And it's actually surprising how little sessions there were on it relative to how much gaming sessions there were in previous years when they actually introduced a sizable amount of frameworks for gaming. For web, I can understand because there actually isn't that much going on relative to web development this year, and there was more so in the past years.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, now that I spoke about the size of WWDC, I would like to speak about the general vibe around the event, and it's nice. Everybody's friendly, and everybody's always open to have a conversation around you. Obviously, you will seem like a jerk if you're not in that mood, but at the same time, I was a little bit surprised by that too. So it's like lots of socializing at every time of the day and between session and exchanging tips and tricks and exchanging experience. So just being at WWDC only to talk to people is a nice experience on its own. So if you add on top of that, being able to attend session and also talk to the speakers, because because I didn't add that much question related to the specific sessions at that point, or I just asked them in the lab. But I know that the speakers are reserved, like during the break between two sessions, they maybe reserve 5 minutes when they are out of stage to just go down and being near the stage and just speak to people that come by. So like this energy of like exchange and collaboration is pretty intense. Like it's really, really, really nice. And like every time they speak about something new, your first gut reaction is just like, oh, I want to try it now. And then you realize that like in 20 minutes after the session, you have another session, and then you came out of the session with that same reaction. So at the end of the week, you're like, I want to try so much stuff. And then you need to fly back home and you just tire and jet lag. So it's a funny vibe to be on for the whole week.
Yeah, definitely.
Good. So now that I spoke about session and blah, 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 I want to speak more about what's outside of WWDC. So like I said in my introduction, like San Francisco during that week is not only the WWDC week, especially this year. I think they had like 2 or 3 events that was on at the same time of DubDub. There was
at the very least there was AltConf and Layers, which were the two big ones.
Yeah, exactly. AltConf that was all week long as WWDC, and Layer was on the Tuesday and Wednesday, if I recall correctly. I think it was only 2 days.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a great mix of people in the city that are there just to be in, like just to enjoy the fact that this big global community at that point is just moving to San Francisco and enjoy San Francisco for a week, because there's tons of events and also tons of people. Like I spoke with so much people that were just there. Yes, attending AllConf, for example. But they told me the first reason is like, yes, I didn't get the ticket, but just being in the city, meeting people and just being part, it's yes, doing networking and being part of the community, but the sentiment of being part of the community and being in San Francisco means you're part of the community during that week is so strong that people just fly to San Francisco for that week and enjoy the vibe. And you know what? Like I came back thinking that yes, next year I need to be there. But this weekend I have to do my finances related to my third, but I might change opinion. Because as most people might know, like big cities are expensive, and especially San Francisco, especially during that week. Obviously I was lucky enough to have, work help me, and I'm not the only one that has that privilege. There's tons of devs that are able to go because of work and might not be able to go if they were indie devs. Because you know what? Like, a week in San Francisco at that time, just for the hotel cost, is about the same price as, or maybe even more expensive than just buying the ticket.
Yeah.
And you haven't eaten anything, and obviously there's free food during the dub, but look, bear with me for a sec. Like, you haven't eat, you haven't fly to San Francisco, so the price of that trip goes really, really fast.
Definitely.
But at the same time, it's kind of, you know what? There's so much value to being in San Francisco during that city, that time, that I think as you can see right now, I've started to look at my numbers. So it's kind of hard to say yes. But at the same time, I can see that for some people it's expensive, but oh my goodness. If you have at least the opportunity to go at least once, like maybe once a couple of years. And I think that's what is going to happen with WWDC is once in a couple of years, you'll get a ticket. And then if you want to go the other years bit in between that period, you'll have to go to the other conference. And the more people that want to attend WWDC, I think the more people will start to create events around it because there will be more demand. And as far as we know right now, there might not be more tickets to get in.
I'm not even sure if that business of side events around WWDC is going to be sustainable or if there are going to be so many of them that the bubble's going to pop and all those are going to go away. Because, like, I was listening to Analog recently and Mike Hurley was at WWDC and he said, like, he had a ticket to Layers and Layers was $800, I believe. For those 2 days, and he was there for like 3 hours total over those 2 days, which is not a huge ROI. I understand, like, maybe if you're a designer, because Layers is a design conference, you would get more out of like 3 hours of sessions than what he got out of 3 hours of sessions. But I'm not sure if that's going to be really sustainable. What seems more interesting to me, and we didn't really talk about this before, but are the viewing parties where you can actually get together with people and watch the keynote, and we're going to whisper this so Apple Legal doesn't hear us, sessions from WWDC together because you couldn't get into the main thing. But even then, like, I was looking years ago at the finances for WWDC, and I just, even if I went, I am not sure I would get what I paid for it out of it in value. It's just not a winning proposition, because what I get the most out of, like, I am not a very social person, so the whole socializing thing is would probably just make me sick. The actual sessions are where I find the value, but the problem is I have less trouble watching the sessions at home where I can skip around and just have more flexibility in what I want to watch and how I want to watch it than if I'm there in person. I mean, like, everyone who was at home watching the videos had a better idea of what was going on at WWDC in terms of announcements than anyone who was at the conference, guaranteed.
Because no,
we could focus on exactly the right sessions, and we could share information on this session is worthless, this session is worthless, skip those, go directly to the ones where the stuff is actually interesting. And I guess what's left then is the labs, and I don't have anything that would necessarily require access to labs, so I'm like, it's not a winning proposition for me to go to WWDC at all.
You know what, I agree with you about the session. Like, after the keynote, during the keynote I was still looking at Twitter, but internet was not so great, obviously, like every other year, so it was hard to follow, but at the same time, like, people was mentioning stuff that was like, what? Like, between the keynote and the State of the Union, people started to speak about, for example, that they are merging all of the dev account into one membership. So you only need one membership for phone, watch, and Mac, and also Safari, but let's talk about that later. And I was like, what? They didn't mention anything about that, but I was like, oh, well, yeah, of course. The second the keynote is done, everything is online. Yeah. And everybody can just go look around and have fun with the documentation, with the new dev portal, and all of that stuff. And this reminds me of a discussion I had at the beginning of the week with one of my colleagues that was still here in Montreal. I was like, you know what? I'm sure you watch way more sessions than I did. Because you could watch session during the day and watch session during the night and watch session during the weekend and have no life.
Yeah, basically. But,
yeah, and if I wanted to have value out of the money that, like, work is paying, but it's still somebody is paying for that, so I need to get value out of it, is I need to, yes, attend sessions, but also enjoy the labs, talk to people, and maybe, like, during the night, I don't want to stay in my hotel room just to watch on shitty internet videos. Yes, I could download them during the day, but you see where I'm going with that. Is you're in San Francisco, there's tons of people, tons of new opportunities, and you want to jump on those.
And, like, a couple months back when I was, like, right back from, when I came back from Japan, we were, like, in your car, and we were talking about, like, how much does it actually cost for me to go to Japan? And I am not entirely sure, but I think it actually might have cost me less to spend a month and a half in Japan than it cost you the entire week in WWDC in San Francisco.
Sadly, I'm sure maybe we'll do the calculation offline and maybe share you with that. Like, maybe just say, like, who was right. But, it was really, really difficult to find an hotel room below $300 for the week.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck, man? Obviously, like, you're happy if you have, like, stocks in any, like, hotel company at that point because you make tons of money. But as a customer, it's like, obviously, there's lots of demand and the offer is always the same. There's the same number of hotel in the area. And obviously, everybody wants to be around the Moscow and US because it's just easy. You want to go to the session, or maybe you want to go to lab for a session, but you don't want to bring all of your stuff, bring all your stuff with you all the day. So you just want to go back to your hotel fast. And there's maybe 10, 15 good hotels. Like, of course you'll be able to find a cheap one, but that's at the same time, do you want to, like, sleep on the floor or something? Like, I'm not saying that you'll literally sleep on the floor, but if you want to stay in a shitty hotel, you can do it. But I heard from people that just, like, share the room with three or more people and do that to bring the cost lower. Bring the cost down, and that's feasible, and I think it's something I would strongly think about if I were to go using my own money for all the week.
Yeah.
Without help from work or a free donation, like a generous donator or something like that. Let's just put it that way.
Are you implying I'm going to give you money to go to WWDC?
I just said a kind person that is giving me money to just enjoy dub next year.
Wow.
You can be that person if you want. I wouldn't mind it.
No, thanks.
Good. So, yeah. To be honest, I think I don't have that much to say. I'm sure maybe I might have some more follow-up the more that I think about my experience. As I mentioned earlier, I'm still, like, being overwhelmed by all of it. I really enjoyed it, and I'm sure that if I have another chance to go, I'll jump on that chance. No question.
Awesome.
Good. So let's jump to part two of our talk for this week. So now what I'll do is I'll go through the presentation topics, the presentation order that you use during the keynote. And Yannick and I will talk about what is the most interesting or we want to work on. I don't know. We'll just talk about stuff and we'll just use the keynote order for getting but you see what I mean. So,
as a rough outline of what we want to talk about.
Thank you. You know, yeah. Like, I'm still, as you can see, I'm still overwhelmed that I cannot speak on that podcast, which is a bit funny, but oh well. So, yeah, rough outline. Let's start with first. What was talk first on the keynote? And I want to mention something first before speaking about the Mac, which was the first stuff, is the kind of small intro that Tim Cook did this year, which was really funny to me. It's like, hello everyone, blah, 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 video, blah, 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 blah. Retail is going fine. The rest of the company is going fine. Dev stuff.
Yeah, it's like the second time that he's done this, because I think at the Watch event where they announced the release date of the Watch, he did the same thing. He was like, yeah, Apple's doing fine. Let's go right into things.
Which I think is a good move. Like, they could do, this year they just did a funny video about how to do the presentation at WWDC. Like, just how can we do the keynote? But I guess I can just do like a retail video in next keynote and that's it.
Yeah, or even like all of this stuff is stuff that's primarily interesting to people who focus on the business side of Apple, and those people are listening to the investor call anyway, and that's where they release all their stats nowadays. So there's no real point to putting that in the keynote where you have a lot of consumers that are watching, and those consumers don't really care about the success of your company. They care about the products that they're going to have in their hands. And obviously, developer keynote is a little different. But at the same time, Apple doesn't really seem to care that it's the developer keynote because the developers have the State of the Union, which is really the developer keynote. So,
yeah, I was about to say that. The keynote is not the developer keynote. It's just a keynote where tons of developers in the room.
I'm sure the developers were thrilled that Drake came on stage to talk about...
Wait,
well,
hey,
whatever.
Don't talk about that. Don't talk about that.
Worldwide keynote. Drake conference.
Come on. Keynote order. Keynote order.
So yeah, the Mac.
Yeah, the Mac. So, what's new on the Mac? What interests you about the Mac?
Well, I think there's a lot. Like, when we didn't mention this earlier, but Phil Schiller, the SVP of Apple Marketing, was a guest on the talk show with John Gruber.
Oh, right. I didn't talk about the after WWDC.
You didn't talk about the after parties at all.
Yeah. Oh, wow. How can I forget about that? I guess I just included and just snapped to networking and enjoying blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so... I was able to get the ticket to it. It was pretty awesome.
It was incredibly refreshing to see an actual person who works at Apple be a part of a podcast, which is like pretty much listened to by everyone in the community, and be open. I was listening to The Rebound right before we started recording, and they were talking on there like... it's very clear that everything that Phil Schiller said there was a marketing answer. I mean, a lot of it felt very marketing and not entirely Phil Schiller being Phil Schiller. But it's also very hard because, again, because they're Apple employees, they never actually open up as themselves. So it's very hard to tell what is marketing spin and what is actually what he thinks.
No, and I'm not surprised about that. Like, I spoke with friends and colleagues and I was like, yeah, it was kind of boring marketing talk. I was like... Okay, like, obviously, now that you mention it, it was, but just the fact that, like, an SVP from Apple is doing something that is more, like, community-driven in a way. Like, let's just say that podcasts, like, and all of the podcasts we do in the community is more, like, just a community thing than if we were doing some keynotes about some stuff. So, the fact that, like, they were able to score him, like, the John and his, I guess, team, unquote, were able to have Phil on a podcast is, like, something to put in history, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think that the value of that episode of the talk show was that Phil is hilarious when combined with Gruber, more so than anything he actually said.
Yeah, I really love how they ended the podcast, which is kind of a spoiler, but oh well. So they talked about their first interaction, which was over email, if I recall correctly. And that was pretty hilarious.
Yeah, why did I mention Phil, though? There was something with regards to the Mac that I wanted to say, but I forgot what. Oh, right. So Phil was trying to say that this release isn't really like a Snow Leopard release, but I'm not sure that really flies with anyone who's paying attention to what they're actually introducing in this build, because it seems to be a lot of refinements and very little in terms of actual features. The only actual features I could actually really name that are user-facing are the window management features. I can't remember a single other feature than that, and that is sort of a problem. Well, it's not a problem because I actually am very, very excited for an OS X release, which is mostly refinements, but it is a problem in terms of trying to make people believe that it's not a Snow Leopard release, I guess.
Yeah, but... Remember with Snow Leopard, there were no user-facing feature new. So no new user-facing feature. Everything was under the hood. So I guess like that's why they don't want to say like it's a Snow Leopard release because there's window management. No, there's also Spotlight, like the Spotlight announcement, which is user-facing. I know it's a little bit of a stretch.
What did they change in Spotlight that you can drag the window? Because that goes into refinements for me. It's so.
No. I'm speaking about the natural language that you can use in Spotlight.
Could you do that already? I mean, I'm pretty sure you could. They trot it out every couple of years to make it look cool.
Oh, but from what I heard, like in the past, you were forced to kind of do query like search, like name or like K name equal blah blah blah, and now I can just say like find the last document, like find all of the document that edited that I've modified in the last month.
Right, or there was show me the messages I ignored from Phil during the keynote.
Which was more of a mail integration, but yeah.
Right, but I think that engine is used across all of Apple's own apps, so it's still valid. I think that the technology was probably there under the hood. It just wasn't as good as it is now, so they made a point to show it off, but it still registers in my head as a refinement and not an actual new feature. And I guess like window management sort of, I mean, with the split view is new, but that's about it. Otherwise, it's just new ways you can do the same things you could already do. Nothing truly exciting there. I think the big thing that is really exciting to me as a Retina MacBook Pro owner is Metal on OS X now, because they've rewritten all of the core graphics frameworks to use Metal now under the hood. So all the graphics stuff on the machine is going to be significantly faster. And sometimes I see the UI chug on my laptop and I'm like, this thing is a power horse and shouldn't be chugging. And hopefully with El Capitan, which we haven't actually said the name of the OS until now, hopefully on El Capitan it'll actually perform to expectations.
From what I heard, it is, even on the beta right now.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have friends and colleagues that already installed it. I have on my work machine, but I just installed it and that's it. I haven't played with it that much yet. So, but from what I heard and what I saw on Twitter, it's pretty fast, even for a beta. Like, at least they fixed the bottleneck of performance on animation. But at the same time, a little bit torn apart. I was having a discussion with one of my colleagues about that, and it's like, yeah, but you know, like, there were, like, for example, he was speaking about the mission control /expose animation. And every other OS, it felt to me that one OS was good, one OS had, like, weird animation. That was, like, dropping frames depending on what you are doing, or even if that nothing opened, it was dropping frames, you didn't know why. But the next update was fine, and you don't know why. So it felt to me that even if they moved that to Metal, it felt to me that they haven't fixed the problem. They're just like, yeah, we're doing shitty code, so let's just put it on something that runs faster, and that's it.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, because I think Yosemite having so much blur makes everything much more choppy just because the blur is involved, and they try to do it live instead of hacking around it like on the Apple Watch. Like, I realize after playing with the Apple Watch so much over the last month, that there are a lot of fake effects all over the place.
Yeah, I'm not surprised about that. The first iPhone was full of it.
Yeah, but specifically the blur effects all over the Apple Watch, that thing is rendered once while the display is open, and then you have to actually wait until the display closes and bring it up again for the blur to actually update and to reflect the actual state of the view under it, which I found funny. I think the blur complicated a lot with regards to animations on Yosemite, and I would have actually liked to see on the MacBook Pro that I own now how Mavericks performed with the same hardware. But that is sort of impossible because it came out this year. One note I had on Metal is that the demo they made during the keynote, which was some game, I think, was it Epic or EA?
Yep. No, it was an Epic demo.
Yeah. Their game was not a very good demo of Metal, because the game that they demoed last year for Metal on iOS looked better than the game they did on OS X, and you would assume that a game on OS X would look much, 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 much better than a game on an iPad. So it wasn't very impressive at all. The demo that was much more impressive was the one in the State of the Union with Adobe software. And Adobe, as you know, sucks at making software on the Mac that actually performs well. So it was very nice to see Adobe software that actually performs well for the first time in years, maybe since 2001.
Yeah, and I think they were using After Effects, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it was After Effects and Illustrator.
Oh, Illustrator. No, that was more okay. So in the Illustrator part of the demo, they were showing like a couple of millions of pixels wide image. And it was like a futuristic city scene. And the guy was demoing that he was able to zoom without derping a frame. And he went from like 1%, like maybe like 50% zoom to like 10,000% zoom. And he was zooming on a small, I remember it was like a small worker that was just like trying to lower, some kind of emergency switch or something. And right. Just the fact that he was using the default swipe gesture, the zoom gesture on the trackpad, and it was as fluid as the gesture is. And just right. That is really impressive because
And the thing to remember, right, is that Illustrator is a vector drawing program, which is much more impressive than if he had done the same thing with just like a bitmap image, because it actually has to work to do the zoom instead of just making the pixels bigger.
Yeah. And that's what surprised me that much. And even the fact that Adobe was like, you know what, we use it in After Effects, and they were able to render the effects pretty, like, instant. I think it was real time. So, and then they moved to Illustrator, and they were like, see, we're able to zoom fast and move and draw fast and blah 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 and fix a typo and blah blah. And then they said something that was really surprising to me, is they plan on moving that metal core, like maybe the wrapper or what they did on top of metal, to other applications like Photoshop, Premiere. And you know what? I think if they do it right, it will make the creative suit good again.
Right. So it's a huge deal for getting people to buy the creative suite. It's also a huge deal for people with Mac Pros, because now Adobe apps are finally going to be able to use that firepower instead of just throwing everything onto the CPU, basically. And I know some people who bought Mac Pros who basically chose Final Cut only because it actually performed way, 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 way better than Premiere, even though they would have preferred Premiere because they're terrible people who don't like Final Cut Pro 10.
Please email Yannick.
Yes. So.
Oh, so wow.
That's a thing.
You went there. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my. But it's funny that you say that. Like, let's go small tangent about Final Cut for a sec. And it's funny
I could make a whole episode on Final Cut. I thought about it.
Okay, but bear with me for that small tangent. It's funny that every time we meet each other and we are like in the small center or something, and we go to the Apple Store and we're like in awe in front of Final Cut, because we kind of used Final Cut 7 on our own or in small school projects, but never did something really big with it. And just seeing Final Cut Pro is like, oh my goodness, way better than Final Cut Pro 7 and blah, blah, blah. We want it. And every time I have that reaction, I'm like, yeah, but I don't have anything to do with it. No video projects.
Yeah. Final Cut Pro 10 is basically the example of what Apple is capable of. Apple knows better than most people in the jobs that they are doing these things. They are future looking. And there's no doubt in my mind that Final Cut Pro 10 is the way that video editing should be. The problem is people have these pre-existing ideas of what video editing should be like, and they are not open to the possibilities of what Final Cut Pro 10 lets them do in less time, because they are used to a certain workflow and they don't want to adapt, which brings us to your episode about software adaptability and all that stuff that we did a couple of weeks ago. And of course, there were some things that were just missing from Final Cut Pro that made it hard to fit into existing workflows. And the problem there is not that Final Cut Pro 10 is a bad application because it doesn't have these things. The problem is that they immediately removed Final Cut Pro 7 from being purchasable everywhere. And then anyone who had a workflow depending on things that were not in Final Cut Pro 10 yet couldn't actually unscrew themselves if, for example, a computer died and they couldn't reuse the license that they had or something to that nature. But Final Cut Pro 10 as an application there's no doubt in my mind, like you would be stupid to use anything else. Sorry, listeners.
Okay, good. Let's close that small tangent before you
get to that. I've gotten that rant out of my system. Oh, and sorry to everyone who listens to this who uses After Effects. I know there are a few of you who do, but I don't hate you, for real.
Good. So, okay. Now, have you anything else to say about the Mac? To be honest,
no.
Okay, I won't say that, but yeah, there's not that much big feature. Obviously, the big one I heard during the session was what's new in, I think it's what's called what's new in NS Collection View. And from what I heard, the Apple made NS Collection View work more like UI Collection View, and everybody hated the NS Collection View and the way it worked and blah, blah, blah. From what I heard, it was just a shitty piece of the API. So nobody really used it and were forced to implement their own. So now it's working more like a UI collection view, which is God, to be honest, on iOS right now. So everybody's pretty hyped and happy about that. But it took them a while.
Yeah, I would be a lot more excited about Mac stuff if I was actively developing a Mac application. But unfortunately, all of the Mac development I've done has sort of been at the command line level. And I've never actually gotten to a point where I actually got a UI working around the core of my app because I canceled the app that I was working on. So that is sort of a thing.
This reminds me of one of your rant about NS Array Controller, which I used a while ago, and it was pretty nice, by the way. But oh well, let's not go on that.
Well, the thing about NS Array Controller was just I didn't understand what the point was. That's all.
Until you use bindings. But okay, let's not go on that. Come on.
I never had to use them. So iOS 9. There were four main themes to iOS 9. Intelligence, apps, iPad, and foundation.
Good. So let's talk on the first one, which is intelligence, right?
God, yeah, this is... Yeah, that's the first one, but... Oh my God, Apple is so going to shoot themselves in the foot with this thing.
Why is that? Because I think most people are complaining that, oh, okay, they're going in a good direction because obviously they want to do more like intelligent stuff. So for example, if they find something in your email, for example, a new meeting or event, they'll just create it automatically. You don't need to create it by yourself. Or some feature was, I thought there were, that was already in, which is like, oh, you already put a map, like a location on your event. It will tell you like where you are right now, how long it will take you, and give you alerts. Like you need to leave now if you want to be on time, which I thought was already in iOS 7 or 8.
I don't remember which version it was, but you have to go explicitly to the calendar to see that information, whereas now it's an alert that automatically pops up.
Oh, that's why. But I'm sure it was like, I saw that feature in the past, but maybe that's why. That was why. You need to go look for it, and then that feature is looking for, that information is now looking for you. Which I think that was the main theme of all of the intelligence. It's like, we want to make sure that you stop trying to find information that you rely on every day. We'll make sure that this information is available to you the second you need it, or at the time you need it.
Right. So I have a bunch of notes from the intelligence section. The first one is sort of global to the entire thing that they presented, which is basically they gave some stats about requests per week with regards to how often people use Siri and all of that stuff. And I think that they really should not speak about stats, because that is a point where Google could just turn around and say, oh yeah, you have X stat. Well, you said X stat per week. We do X stat per day or something like that, because they get so much more information from everyone that they are going to look stupid if they keep repeating these stats that out of context seem wow, but as soon as Google says, oh well, we get this many requests, they will look pathetic in comparison.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I was assuming that they showed this stat to maybe like in the future they'll show us a new stat and we'll be able to compare it with the last one and say like, hey, remember that old stat we gave you about Siri? Now it's twice of the same, like twice as of requests per day. And we'll, like, here's why we did those new features for Siri, because there's so much more people that is using it right now, and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. I could see that marketing speech.
Yeah, I can see that as well. The problem is, of course, it's fine to do that when you're the number one in your field, but Apple is not the number one in their field, and Google exists, and Google's thing is also cross-platform. So Google just needs to say one stat, and it's probably going to destroy whatever stat Apple has.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
So that was just something I noted. There's this proactive thing, which is basically the name that they're using for all this functionality. And if there is something that you commonly do every day at a certain time, well, on your lock screen when you open your phone, there's already going to be an icon for it in the bottom left, as if it was a handoff activity. The first thing that popped to mind for that is, okay, but what if that conflicts with handoff? Like, they are all bunching a bunch of things. You have, like, the recommendations for apps that are in a place close to you. You have handoff. You have proactive, all jammed into this little icon in the bottom left corner. I don't think that scales very well going forward. And I think that, to be honest, the lock screen implementation of all of the proactive features is just lazy and not good.
Yeah, maybe you want to touch that more later. But also the fact that, like, some of the proactive feature are accessible via the search UI. And now the search UI has two homes. First one is the new one that was introduced in iOS 7, which is you swipe down from the icon list. And the other one is the back. Like, if you're on the first page of the old screen, there's like a left page which has like a search icon as an icon. So you swipe to go to that page, and then voila, back to iOS 6 world.
Yeah, I was actually concerned that they would get rid of the pull down on the home screen gesture, because I think that that is much, much more useful than the first page. I know that it's duplicate functionality, but the trick with pulling down from the home screen is it works on any home screen, whereas if you're on the other one, you have to actually go to the minus one screen to actually use search. So I don't want them to get rid of it, because I use that feature so much that it would bother me to have to go back all the time.
The small problem I have with the search in the icon list is sometimes, like, if you swipe fast and you're not looking at your phone, you might trigger the notification center. And it happens to me sometimes. I'm not saying, like, it's a small complaint here. Like, it happens to me enough that I can't say that.
Actually done that, but I also have an iPhone 6 now, so I think maybe the screen size also doesn't help because you're on a 5S.
Okay, that might be why, but...
But I've never had that issue even on smaller phones.
Hmm.
So I just... Maybe our positioning of our fingers on the screen is different.
No, just be honest and tell me I don't know how to use my phone.
Well, that too.
Oh, come on!
There's one thing I wanted to note on, which is proactive functionality makes me think that third-party default apps will never happen, ever, and that people who are pursuing that dream should give up.
No, right. And I don't know if you have taken a look at the search API session. I haven't watched it yet, but I heard a lot about it. And to be honest, like, this week, there's people starting to post a screenshot of their implementation of the Search API, meaning that they are saying, like, here's, take a look at my screenshot, take a look at my app. It will have an update that will use that. And you'll be able to search, for example, I know I've saw the Apple app for a podcast, but yeah, I'll be able to search for a podcast. At the same time, I'm able to search for Dropbox content and Overcast podcasts and whatever.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about search being polluted, because right now the betas do not have a way to shut off search for certain apps. So if you have apps that pollute the search results with a bunch of crap you don't care about, you can't actually turn them off, which is a problem. Another thing I am very, very, very concerned about is, I don't know, in the keynote, I think it was, there was an example of using search, and you search for, like, sprained ankle, and then it recommends, like, the top three results are apps that are recommended for if you have a sprained ankle, and that shit needs to stop. I know that app discovery is a problem on the App Store. Fix it on the goddamn App Store. Don't go jamming it into search where I'm trying to find actual results instead of giving me apps. Like, this is part of the thing that infuriates me about this app indexing and everything BS, is that if I am going to look for reference information, I'm not going to install your application because it's going to be a one-time thing. The web exists. It does its job perfectly well. I don't want to install your stupid app. The problem is, if apps start showing up above everything else in the search results, it just makes my search experience worse.
But they will always do that because if I recall correctly...
Yeah, I turn all of that off because I don't want it.
Yeah, but also there's like... Are you referring to the list of maybe four or five icons that is always sticky? Because I remember this one...
No. This is not like on the search page. This is when you do a search
query. Oh, I see.
If you search for something that is in the keywords of an app on the App Store or that has content relevant to that, those three apps will pop up at the top of the search results. The problem is, I don't want that. I want results from the web, probably, if I'm doing a search. Because, like, I understand that there's going to be content in my apps, but honestly, I don't care about app indexing at all. I really don't want any of that functionality. You gave me something I didn't want. Like, if I want to search, I want to search on the web. I don't want to search inside of apps. And now I have to deal with this app garbage in my search, and it's sort of a problem.
Yeah, to be honest, I guess we'll see, because I'm pretty happy about that new feature, and you don't seem to be, so...
I mean...
We'll see. No, we'll see. That's fine. At least for once, we're against quote-unquote, each other for that feature. Like, I see the positive side to it, and it seems to me that Apple has figured out the way to do better intelligent stuff while, like, making sure that stupid stuff don't happen. They might not block all of the stupid stuff and block all of the stupid, like, ad stuff or what you're referring to. But it seems to me they are in a good direction. And...
Like to me, Spotlight, there was a thing back in the good old jailbreak days, like on iOS 3, that I used that let you type URLs into the Spotlight field and automatically open them. That was really, really useful because basically all I use the Spotlight bar for is doing web searches, Wikipedia searches, and ideally, I would like to type URLs directly there because I would love to just open the page directly from that. Or that if the field detected something that looked like a URL, just let me open the damn URL. Because I don't want to have to launch Safari and then go to the place. The problem is, like, if you thought that the value of Spotlight was to be your window to the web, that entire thing is going away because now apps are going to be contaminating the results. And, like, if I'm looking for something, I have so few apps on my phone that I actually care about searching for stuff for that I'll just go to the app. It's simpler to do that, and I'll know I'll get exactly what I want. But the problem is I also have a bunch of apps right now that are installed precisely because they have an extension that I care about, but I don't care about the contents of the app at all. Or something on the watch that I think is useful on the watch but is not useful on the phone that I will never use on the phone. Now, because I don't have the functionality to turn off those apps, I have all of this garbage polluting my Spotlight results, and it's less useful to me. And if I can make the default in Spotlight be just put a big search web, search Wikipedia button at the top of the thing, and also, by the way, you shouldn't do like you're doing right now and wait for the search results for every section to finish loading before showing me those two buttons, which is infuriating. I don't know. Spotlight is so bad right now and it does so little that I don't want them jamming more things into it unless they can make the basic functionality that I actually want better.
Oh, well, but you know what, you touch a point that I really, like, I think it's not part of Spotlight, but I would really like to see is maybe being able to have, like, maybe it will be our segue to the watch stuff, but, like, you touch on that if you want to have the watch app, you need to have the iPhone app because they're still packaged together. Same for extensions. Yeah. I would like Apple to do something way better than that right now. I know that the App Store is a place for apps, so to put extension, you need an app. But I will feel like if there's a place that I could just only download, for example, the Foursquare extension for my phone and have the Foursquare app, the full-on Foursquare app on my watch, that's it. I wouldn't care about having the Foursquare app on my phone and only have Sworn on my watch, not on my phone.
Yeah.
Stuff like that, like a different combination of that, will be way, way, way better. And I guess, in part, we'll fix the problem you're mentioning about Spotlight.
I don't know. There's so much that is wrong with Spotlight right now that I have zero confidence that this will turn out well.
We'll see. So, next feature?
I have more notes on this.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, I do. So, yeah, Siri being more powerful is incredibly interesting because it's increasingly becoming the fastest way to do stuff on your phone, faster than doing it manually, which was not necessarily the case when it was launched. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think it will say like that was the vision they had for Siri, but as we all know that Apple and cloud services, they kind of still don't go together. So they are working on that and at a fast pace, I would say. And that's nice to see that a Siri is getting better.
The other last thing I want to mention is privacy, because this is the new theme that Apple is. They're basically showing themselves as a superhero of privacy. And I think it's good because personally, I'm not interested in company is knowing too much about what it is I'm doing. The problem is the intelligence features that they're delivering can only be so strong if they do stuff locally. So one of my concerns is all of this is happening locally. So do I have to relearn everything if I clean install on my phone? And as far as I know, yes, it has to relearn everything because none of this is going into the cloud, apparently.
Yes, and the same can be applied, for example, if you have an iPhone and an iPad. So your phone has to learn everything, and then your iPad has to learn everything, and that's it.
And that's a terrible user experience, because people assume that that kind of intelligence is everywhere, because Google does that.
Yeah, but I guess if they're able to make it seem seamless, that will be fine. It's something we'll see, or what will happen is it will be a little bit more intelligent than it is right now, and that will be probably it.
Like, the way I see it is, if you're not going to do it right, don't do it. And the problem is, all of this proactive stuff, I have a bad vibe about it, a very bad vibe. And part of that is because Apple sucks at cloud services, and so I have zero confidence that they're going to get it right. And the other thing is, what they could do to actually do a better job is actually collect information from their users. And the problem that I have with Google specifically, and well, those kinds of companies, is that they are ad companies. They are not incentivized to actually do things in service of the user. They are incentivized to do things in terms of tracking for advertisers. So the incentives aren't in the right place. It's a question of trust. It's not a question of, like, you know what I mean? Like,
no, I know. But and also, like, maybe to be more on the Google side for a sec is, remember, like, Cook gave a speech at some kind of weird event about privacy, and they were like, "Yeah, we will never sell your data." And you know what?
Well, I have a fun note about that.
Yeah, okay, I'm sure there's a fun note about that. But also, like, as far as I know, Google is never selling your data.
No, it's they're not
using
data.
The data and say, telling to advertisers, like, see how much data we have about our users? If you come join our ad network, you'll be able to benefit from it. But we won't
give it to you.
You
can target based on the data. So you can say, I want people with these attributes in their data to see my ad. But you can't say, I want to have Lucrativia's data. It doesn't work like that.
No, also, and you cannot say, I want, like, a bunch of data from a bunch of users too. Like, they're not selling the data. They're using it to sell ads.
Right.
Which is just the problems. Like, Apple, I know Apple is like, we will never sell your data. And Google is kind of doing that too. They're never selling your data per se. Right. They're just using it to do ads with it.
Right. So my problem is not, I'm opposed to the collection of my data. My problem is, what are their incentives? And what can they do with my data in service of those incentives? And I think that Apple's are much more in line with the consumer than Google's are. And that is why I would have no problem handing over my user data to Apple. However, they are not interested because they are harping on this privacy thing because they also don't want the government to have access to my data. And that is a whole other ballgame. And honestly, as much as I would like the government isn't going to get my data, they probably can, even with what Apple is trying to do right now. I have zero confidence that the government is not able to get my data, right? So I don't know. It seems like they're harping on this privacy thing too much. And I think we should probably move on to the next thing because we have an actual time limit this time around. And I'm spending all this time ranting about Spotlight and Proactive and how much I don't like it. And but you, I think like their services will suffer because they don't have all of this data. And I don't think they'll ever be competitive with Google with regards to what they can do locally on the device. And I think that's a problem for them in the long run.
I agree, and we'll just like to mention that you were the one complaining about the time limit, so, and you're the one blah, 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 so that's good. So, yeah, I hope that in the end, Siri will get better, and that's what I want to do. That's what I want to have it. Like, I want a better Siri, and that's it. Like, maybe it won't be as good as Google search feature, but if I have a better Google, a better Siri, and maybe I'll do a little more privacy, like a sentiment of privacy, I think I'll be fine.
Next up in the keynote was Apple Pay.
No. Let's skip Apple Pay. No.
Actually, I have one point I would like to make, which is positive.
How can it be positive? No Canada support yet.
That's coming in the fall. Don't worry about it.
It's rumored. Yes. I did follow up with that, so.
Yeah, but it's so far in advance from the fall that they're going to announce it when they announce the new iPhone and not at this event. I was not surprised that the Canada support was not in the keynote. I'm sorry.
Okay, go on.
The most interesting thing is Square announced that they partnered with Apple Pay to have an Apple Pay-capable NFC reader for Square vendors, and I think that is fantastic and that it should have happened a long time ago, but it's nice to see this happen because I have people in my family who sell things with Square, and this would be a cool addition to them. Okay, next point.
Yeah, don't talk about Apple Pay. It makes me really, really sad. I know the rumor says it was UK, and they announced UK, and they announced blah, 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 like store cards, which I don't care, but you know what?
This fall, man.
Yeah, but you know what? Like, my small tangent about Apple Pay is just like, have you been in the US recently?
No. Actually, yeah. The last fall.
Did you spend tons of money in the US?
No.
That's why. My goodness. Signing every time you buy something with credit is so old school.
Oh, I just use cash, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's why. Oh my goodness. I complain about that all week long. Oh my goodness. Like, you see, like, right now I'm just like,
okay,
I don't know what to say.
Let's take your mind off of it and talk about apps instead.
That's good. That's good.
So the built-in apps to the iPhone have been improved. There's Notes, which is now much more competitive with OneNote, and apparently runs on CloudKit under the hood now, which is interesting.
So maybe I'll have a reason to drop a simple note.
Maybe. Maps. The big thing, of course, is transit. It's in 10 cities in North America. It's in 10 cities
in the West
and also most of China. It looks really pretty. There's also a nearby view. One of the things that I will note about the nearby view is it is still powered by the terrible point of interest database that Apple Maps has. So I'm going to have so much fun with that when I install the beta on my phone.
Yeah, it's going to be funny.
It's going to be hilarious.
Especially if, like, for example, you do that same search on Apple Maps and, for example, something like Foursquare or Yelp. I'm sure it'll be funny. By the way, speaking of that, like, I know that Toronto is on the list of the 10 cities that will support it. But I was like, oh, come on. Because you remember that, like, they've drawn on the map the entrance of the underground stations. And Montreal is pretty known by its underground city, which is downtown Montreal. So sure, it will be a pretty nice feature to have in Montreal, but oh well.
There's that Montreal entitledness we all love. Next point, Apple News. So Apple has their own news app now, which is very, very, very similar to Facebook Instant Articles.
Or Flipboard.
I think it looks more like it was Facebook Instant Articles. Under the hood, it seems to be mostly RSS right now. Unlike Flipboard or crowd favorite Nuzzle, there does not seem to be any social functionality whatsoever, which is surprising. Anyone with a blog can subscribe to be a news publisher at icloud.com/news publisher.
And you don't need to subscribe if you're popular or if you're lucky enough.
If you're popular, you will get a message from Apple saying you've been opted into the news thing, and we hope that you accept our terms and services. If not, please reply to this email, which is sort of strange.
Yeah, they mentioned a lot. Mentioned the web crawler a lot, and not maybe in the keynote, but they mentioned it in the State of the Union and in a couple of sessions that Apple has now some kind of, they call it like AppleBot, or I don't remember the name, but whatever, AppleBot, and it will be a web crawler that will do tons of stuff. For example, it will add blogs for Apple News. Also, it will be used to crawl website for the universal link feature we didn't talk about in the search talk, but the gist of it is you're being able to, for example, when the OS sees a Twitter HTTP link, you'll be able to say that, oh, I'm Twitter, it's my website. You can also use that URL, remove the HTTP stuff, and just use a URL scheme to open my app to that tweet directly. So they'll use the crawler to get all of those metadata off of website, which is kind of interesting too. And I think they will use it to make the like proactive stuff more intelligent.
Yeah.
And that's probably it. Like, you know what? Like, I stopped using RSS a while ago. I know that you still use it. So maybe I'll follow some stuff. Maybe it will be easier than just like following like Twitter accounts of blogs on Twitter, but like I left RSS because there's still like I was following so much blog that I was like overbooked with stuff to read and stuff to learn about. So I was like, just fuck that shit, just I'll read what I want to read at a particular time and I'll just go dig that for that.
Yeah, the issue I have with that mentality is there are so many blogs that I read that don't have any kind of social media presence so that I can follow that RSS is the only option. And if I'm going to use RSS for those blogs, I might as well just use it for everything. So that's what I do. Next up in the keynote was iPad stuff. There are a lot of changes for the iPad. One of them is the keyboard, which now has a shortcut bar on the iPad where you can add little shortcuts that are specific to your application, sort of like input accessory views are right now. But there's also cut, copy, paste stuff there if you're on the iPad, which is handy. Yeah. There's a track. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. It will, in my opinion, it will make the predictive bar more interesting and more more useful, because to me, like, it's just a tad bar. So now that it has like keyboard shortcut on it, that's a good feature.
Oh. Yeah, there is a trackpad mode for quick text selection. So by using two fingers on the keyboard, you can now use it as a trackpad would be used on a laptop to do text selection, which is looks really impressive. I'm not sure how it works in practice because I haven't installed the betas yet, but
that
looks exciting.
Yeah, I saw it in person today. That's amazing. But my colleague and I were not able to figure out how to do text selection. We're like trying to pinch, try to do something weird. So maybe I'll have to take a look at the keynote again to see how to do it. But to be honest, like this, the two finger swipe around the keyboard gesture is pretty nice to move the cursor way, way, way faster than the old behavior. And it's so funny because like, I know if I recall correctly, like Google announced for the new version of Android, the iOS way of text selection, but the old iOS way to do text selection for the phone and for tablets. And now that Apple is bringing those features for the iPad to make the iPad more productive, and they're moving forward already. It's quite funny.
Yep. After
that, they introduced the multitasking feature for the iPad. So the multitasking is composed of three features. The first one is PIP, which is picture in picture, which is my favorite one right now, which is for maybe video player apps. It's mostly for video player apps. So right now, this feature will be supported on most iPads that will run iOS 9. And what it will give you the opportunity to do is to, for example, launch Netflix, go on full screen mode and say, like, not in full screen mode, pardon me, you will play a video and ask the app to just shrink it, and you'll be back on the home screen with the shrunk version of the video still playing. So you'll be able to go on, for example, Safari with the video still playing and still visible on the screen. So you'll be able to multitask while watching something on your iPad. I cannot wait to do that with Netflix. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, someone who's been watching a lot of Twitch streams this week, it'll be very interesting going forward.
Yeah, and right now I just mentioned Netflix because I imagine that Google will be slow to adopt that for the YouTube app, so I guess I'll have to wait tons of time for
oh my
it.
God.
Yes. So I'm sure you'll be fine with Twitch. I'm sure I will be fine with Netflix, but I watch tons of car videos on YouTube, and I'm sure it will take so much time for them to get that feature. But oh well.
It's time to start watching them in Safari instead, because Safari's video player will do it.
Right. That's a good idea. Oh yeah. I now remember about it. So next point is the next multitasking feature is called Slide Over, which is also supported by most iPads. So this will make you, this will bring another app. And I don't know if it's all of the apps or this like kind of like favorite or more like the most popular apps you use on your iPad, but
it's all apps that have been updated to support the multitasking.
Okay, features. I want to try about it. So what it will give you the opportunity to do is to slide over another app while your other app is kind of going in the background. So you'll still see, for example, you're surfing on Safari and you get a mail notification, but you don't want to switch to mail. You just want to glance at it, so you'll be able to do the slide over gesture, and the mail app will be able to be like the width of the iPhone size app on the iPad, but it will be the full height of it. So you'll be able to interact with it and then just slide it away and go back to Safari, for example. And then you'll be able to do that with all of the apps that support multitasking. And the main feature of multitasking, which sadly is only available, sadly and obviously so only available for the iPad Air 2, because that iPad is a workhorse machine, is split screen, which is, as its name suggests, and we talk about that for the Mac, will bring the opportunity to put two apps at the same time on screen. And you'll be able to select the amount of split you choose for us. So if I recall correctly, it's like 1/3 of a screen, 2/3, half and half, and 2/3, 1/3, which is pretty neat.
Yep.
Anything you want to add on that?
Not really, no.
Do you have an iPad Air 2 or not? I don't remember.
Just iPad Air 1.
Oh, okay. So you're a little bit like me. I'm like, I wish I had an iPad Air 2 to try that.
Well, honestly, I'm looking forward to this iPad Pro thing that might come out.
to be honest, there was rumor last year that it might come out. I'm sure it's coming out this year. Because I'm sure, have you seen the tweets from Steven Trottosmith that he was able to run the simulator in iPad Pro mode?
Yep, and the keyboard is bigger. I don't actually like the enhanced keyboards with more keys on the side, so I'm worried because I don't really want that. But
what do you think about the new row? Because you have like the numbers on top of the keyboard now.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, they added that, which is kind of okay, because they have the same look as the function feature on Apple keyboard, so they are smaller.
That's probably why I didn't notice. I have no need for those, but okay, whatever.
And the other rumor that I heard is right now when you do like split screen 50-50 for each app, the width of like the size class for the width will be compact on the iPad Air 2. And the rumor says that for the iPad Pro, the width size will be regular.
Right, that makes sense.
So this will mean that you'll be able to have two iPad-like UI on the iPad, on the rumored iPad Pro, and the iPad Air 2 will only have like two iPhone app-sized apps.
Yeah. As a user, I'm excited for this functionality. As a developer, there are certain parts of my app that I'm not looking forward to fixing for this because they're not really cool. But we'll see.
By the way, do you plan to support it? Because I know that your app EOS is pretty CPU and GPU. It's mostly CPU intensive.
Well, I'm not sure yet. The thing is, like, I don't think it really makes sense at the various splits because the video would be so small that it almost doesn't make any sense. But for something like the iPad Pro, if you can have two large apps running side by side, then maybe it makes more sense there. But I haven't evaluated all of that yet because it's still kind of theoretical and I'm still working on an update before I jump into iOS 9 stuff. So,
yeah, because I think the biggest surprise for that is since both apps are running at the same time, they need to use less resource because they'll share the same RAM, same CPU. So if one is pretty CPU intensive, the other app might have no CPU time at all. Like, no quote-unquote CPU time at all. So,
right, but at the same time, I haven't actually been able to test my app on an iPad Air 2, even on iOS 8. So I don't even know how much of a resource hit there is on that device compared to an iPad Air. So it would be interesting to see that.
Good. So
let's move on because we have a lot left. I'm going to sprint through this stuff because really we want to get to watchOS and we want to get to Apple Music. Well, maybe we'll have to skip Apple Music because we don't have that much time, but we'll see. Foundation changes. Graphics frameworks, much like on OS 10, are on Metal now, so 1.6 times improvements in draw speeds. Awesome. An extra hour of battery life compared to iOS 8 and a new low power mode for 3 more hours of typical use from a full charge, which is also interesting.
Yeah, and that 3 hours is on top of the 1 hour. So like with the low power mode, you get far more compared to iOS 8.
Yeah.
Which is pretty nice.
Yeah. Two-factor authentication is also now supported when in setting up a new device, which it wasn't before. That was one of the ways in which you could hack other people's devices. So it's nice to see that that is gone. And of course, our favorite is smaller downloads for over-the-air updates on iOS 9. iOS 9 will be 1.3 gigabytes over the air, which is still sort of big, but is not as bad as the 4. Whatever it was before.
Seriously, you should have seen my face. I was like, oh, yay! So I guess it's something that I won't be able to complain next, like in a couple of months, about iOS 9. Yay! They fixed that! Yay!
Go ahead.
And related to that, they introduced a bunch of new features for a developer to use. The main one is, they call it on-demand resources. So you could just say to Apple, like, okay, I want a bunch of resources that I need, not when I need to first launch my application. And when you'll need it, you'll be able to request them to the Apple server, the App Store Apple servers, and you'll be able to download them and just cache them. And if you haven't used a resource for a while, it would get thrown away to keep the storage space slow.
Yeah, I know they're primarily focusing this towards games. The problem is, like, it's sort of a thing that's already being done in games, specifically free-to-play ones. So I'm not sure if anyone will adopt this instead of just using a cross-platform thing they built for Android and iOS, because they're going to be doing it for both platforms anyway. So not sure about that. And it's sort of tone-deaf to people who download games before getting on a plane, and then they get in the plane and they're like, oh, well, I need this on-demand resource, and then you can't play the rest of the damn game in the plane, which is really not fun if you're doing a cross oceanic flight. Not that I'm bitter.
Yeah, and the other one, which is done automatically, if I recall correctly, is app slicing. So, for example, and app slicing too.
Well, it's a subset of that functionality. Yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Though. Okay, so app thinning
slash. The entire app thinning thing is app slicing plus on-demand resources plus bitcode, which is discussed extensively on this week's ATP, so let's not talk about it here.
Yeah, just the gist of it is you compile your code to some kind of bitcode, and the App Store will be able to recompile it to do later optimization. And that's nice and scary at the same time. They have a big talk also on the latest Debut podcast about it. So another episode if you want to have more details about it. And about app slicing is, for example, I'm sure most people like seen the recent downloads of, like, maybe the recent updates of, maybe if I recall correctly, Spotify is this way, and tons of like Twitter app is this way too. Like, you're downloading a simple app that speaks to a server and it's like 100 meg, and you're like, what the fuck is happening with that app to be so big? And obviously it is because they have like tons of images for their UI, and they have 1x images for the old iPads and 2x images for most of the phone and most of the iPads, and have 3x images for the iPhone 6 Plus. So, and they also have like a fat binary, 32 bits, 64 bits. And so the App Store right now will be able to compartmentalize all of that. And for example, if a user is downloading your application for 6 Plus, it will be able to just say like, okay, I need the 3x images and the 64-bit app, package that back to an app and send it to the server, to the user. And the user will have an optimized version of the application that only has what it needs to run for that particular device.
Really exciting stuff. I have a bunch of features from that slide with a bunch of words on it that I want to point out as being exciting. So one of them was app thinning. There's also wireless CarPlay, which I think you are very excited about.
Yes and no. Like, I'll be honest.
Well, would be if your car supported it.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, driving a display over Wi-Fi in the car with GPS
it's kind of worrisome.
Yeah, and with GPS and all that stuff, like, I'm sure my battery will drive so fast. So I will, like, really like that feature. True. If I'm just like doing errands in the city where I just jump in the car, get out of the car and jump in back in. But if I'm doing a long drive, I will just plug my phone back in.
That's
true. Right now with Bluetooth audio, it's fine to do like 2-3 hours on the charge, which obviously even after a long 3-hour drive, your phone will still have tons of battery to go. But can you imagine like driving a display over Bluetooth Wi-Fi-ish at the same time while you're running the GPS and playing music, and then and 1 hour later you use like 50% of your battery? So it's nice in theory, to be honest.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to see in practice, because in a way what you're describing is sort of the Apple Watch. So it's kind of different, but at the same time, it's similar in other ways. And if the screen of the phone is off and it's the biggest power suck, then maybe it's not as bad as we're expecting, but we'll see.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like the driving of the display on the watch is done by the watch itself.
Yeah, but your phone isn't going to be powering the display in the car.
Yeah, too. Okay, right. Good point.
So next up, audio unit extensions I'm personally excited for. This means that you can expose little functionality. Like basically you can make audio plugins for other audio apps so that they can work together in one app instead of doing something like they're doing right now, which is sort of like Audio Bus, where audio gets passed as a pipeline from one app to the next, and then comes out to the output. So more flexibility there, which is exciting. It will let you do cool stuff with audio that is not not in real time. Because right now, the only effects you can really do from one to the other is passing it in real time, as far as I can tell. Stack View is exciting. It is a way for iOS developers to make you the most common UIs in much, much simpler. And it uses auto layout under the hood, but basically you don't have to do any constraints. And as someone who has spent the last 3 days wrangling with auto layout constraints, I can say, hell yes, you want to do this. And I can't wait to adopt this in my app. The last point, which is not a positive, it is a negative, is iOS 9 supports all compatible devices with iOS 8, which means that the A5 will not die and it is immortal.
Yeah, I know. But I hope that on the performance, like the improved performance on also older devices, there was a rumor on that the iOS 9 will have two kernels, but two cores, say it that way. They have like the new core that is optimized for new devices, because that's what they used to do with older version of the OS. For example, when they launched like the iPhone, let's say the iPhone 5S with iOS 7. So iOS 7 was greatly optimized for the new phone. And then they launched iOS 8 with the new iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, which was heavily optimized for those phones too. And now the rumor says, because it hasn't been confirmed yet that it is the case, but rumor says that iOS 9 will have like a core optimized for newer phones and a core optimized for old phones. So we'll see. But yes, you're right. iPad 2 is still living. That iPad 2 will never die. Never, never, never die.
Yep. Next up was Swift 2.
Before we go to SwiftUI, just like when you mentioned the cloud image for iOS, I remembered two things that I really loved about the cloud image for the cloud world image about the Mac is, first of all, photo extension. Yay! And second is GPS editing on Photos app, which was a feature.
Whoa, I didn't hear that.
So you can edit geo-coordinate, like geo-coordinate metadata on your photos now. I had a discussion again with one of my good colleagues today about that. He was like, yeah, now we'll be finally able to do that in El Capitan and just make sure, because like that's the feature it was missing from Aperture. He's like, I just want to edit the geo tags on my photos. And now it's coming back. So now nice. Swift, open source, yay, version 2.0, yay!
Right, so there are two big things, basically. There's the Swift 2 is open source, and there's going to be a Linux port on release this fall, which is exciting, and it is probably going to mean an explosion of web frameworks based on Swift, so look forward to that. And the other thing is that I thought it was sort of surprising that there were also many tweaks to Objective-C that were bundled as part of this Swift 2 update, namely lightweight generics and nullability being expressible in Objective-C now. So instead of changing the APIs so that they are more Swift-friendly, they changed Objective-C so that it has more functionalities from Swift so that they can build that stuff in, which is strange to me, but okay, I'll take it.
By the way, the nullability was introduced in Swift 1.2 and Xcode 6.3. So it was not a new feature. It was like they reminded us that it still exists. But something I really like about Swift 1.2 is, I'm still not sure about their error management, but the fact that they are converting the old way of managing error on Objective-C with NS error pointer to the new way with Swift without you doing anything except following the convention is pretty nice. Like, it's a pretty feat that they were able to do that.
Yeah, it's really cool. The problem is, I know a lot of developers who are developing on iOS, which come from non-Mac and iOS backgrounds, and they don't understand the conventions. So that's going to be fun.
Yeah, but I guess it will incentivize them to learn about the convention, master them, and make sure that their old code base is now using those new conventions, because it will be way easier for them to convert their old code base or maybe make use of their old code base written in Objective-C with their new code with Swift.
At least until they write asynchronous tasks.
Okay, maybe. But I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure. I'll have to play with it more. But also, related to that, which was something more related about the session, is all of the code in the session, all the code example called samples, is in Swift.
Yes. Most of the WWDC sessions, the ones that don't involve new features in Objective-C, they all use Swift, unless the code was crashing, in which case they used Objective-C.
Which is sad. Which really,
poor
really,
Objective-C.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know what? Like, most developers do that error in Objective-C. Like, oh, I'm sure people do some kinds of error in Swift too, but oh well.
Well, there are a lot of errors that you can't make in Swift because it won't compile. The problem is you're not too sure what you have to do to get it to compile.
Which is a new feature of Swift too. They'll make better error messages.
Right.
But from what I remember of Microsoft's new frameworks, every time there's a new version of their framework, it's like, yeah, better error messages. It's like, not really.
Yeah. We still have watchOS and maybe Apple Music to go through in like 7 minutes. So
you know what? Let's keep Apple Music, because I know it was part of my follow-up, so that's why I was teasing in the follow-up. So maybe let's do that next episode. And because like I know, like I'm having fun, but I'm still really jet lagged this week, so it's kind of funny. Like it's.
Except by the time that we get to it, it won't be relevant anymore, which is sort of sad, but okay.
To be honest, I guess like next episode will happen during the launch of it.
Well, next episode, we already have a topic that you don't know about, so.
Oh, okay. So I'm sure we'll be able to do it fast. So watchOS, new feature, native apps, to be honest, yet again, I'm pretty hyped about the watch because you and I both own one, but I still haven't found good ideas to write apps on it yet. So I guess now that the WatchKit extension is not running on your phone, but running on your watch, explains a lot of the stuff and explains why you won't have to rewrite all of your app, just fix some tweak, because it's not a full-on native app the way we do native app on iOS. It's just that they move the WatchKit extension from your phone to your watch. But this also means that the UI is running its own process and the extension is running another process. So they're still kind of like, they're not being able to talk directly to each other.
Right. Cool stuff about watchOS. Third-party complications is something that a lot of people have been excited for. So that is cool. I still have no intention of changing my complication setup, so I'm not sure why. I'm not very excited by that right now.
We'll see. I'm sure some app will give you a reason to change your setup with third-party complications.
I'm not sure.
We'll see.
Nightstand mode. So now, if you bought an Apple Watch stand, you can regret it because you can now just put your Apple Watch on its side and get a nice little nightstand.
Which I do all night. Which I'll do every night.
Right.
I was so happy about that feature. And like in the last week, like in most people podcasts I listen to, it's like, what? Why do you want to put your watch on the side? I was like, how the hell are you charging it? And then I realized, oh, maybe they bought the stand. So that's why they don't put it on its side.
I don't put it on its side. I put it flat down on the little puck thing, but I'm gonna start doing it when I can get the nightstand thing. The only thing that worries me about it is burn-in, because it's an OLED screen and I hate on OLED because I'm an asshole.
You're stealing my line now, but that's fine.
Let's see, there's a bunch of other stuff, but I'm gonna skip over the boring stuff. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay, maybe I'll do it for you. So obviously they introduced new frameworks. So obviously they moved some frameworks that were available on iOS, and then now you'll be able to access them on the watch. One example, like core animation. They also move core data and stuff like that. They also introduced new framework that will give you access to all of the sensors, all of the new like the hardware features on the phone, on the watch. So you'll be able to have access to the heartbeat sensor, to the taptic engine, and all that stuff. So yeah, to me, it's like they added those features, and I guess people will use it, but it's a big update. But on its own, like if people doesn't start to adopt those, I'm pretty sure that the watch app will be way faster, and that's probably it. So I'm still like trying to understand why they haven't shipped with that first. And like, remember the rumors that said that the watch was about to like was supposed to be released last fall, and then it started to make sense that they were supposed to launch WatchKit 1 with the watch last fall and not this spring. So like, they are about to launch, like, we already have the iOS betas and the WatchKit the WatchOS betas, but, like, they are starting to ship, to sell the watch in Apple stores. Like, I think they started that yesterday, today. So, like, it felt strange to me, but oh well.
Yeah, the argument I can find against the people who say it should have shipped without WatchKit 1, like, I agree it wasn't ready, but the other thing I can suggest to those people is, well, go to your Apple Watch app and disable all of your Apple Watch apps that you have installed and try living like that for a couple of days and see if you enjoy it. And we'll talk next week and see if you like it. And I'm not convinced you like it as much as if you have the WatchKit apps, because as bad as the WatchKit apps are, they actually do provide functionality that is genuinely useful.
Yeah, you're right. And sometimes they are really fast. And when they are really fast, you're really surprised about it. And that's nice. That's a good way to start your day. Like, oh, I want to go to what? Trendsetter was really updated. That's nice. That's a way to start the day.
Yep. So let's get on to Apple Music.
Okay. You know what? I know they have tons of stuff to say about it, so I'll jump first. So, pre-write about the service. I'm sure that I'm sure I will move from Spotify to Apple Music. I've been a long time user and fan of Spotify. I was lucky enough to have access to it in Canada while it was not yet in Canada. Ooh. But I've been a pretty good fan of streaming services. And to be honest, the main argument for me to use Apple Music is just to have my music in one place. So I have some stuff I bought that is already in my music app, and then I'll be able to just have all of the music I want in one app, which is integrated in OS. So that's nice. Now I know that people didn't like the presentation. The presentation was okay, not great, not the best presentation ever. It was rambling. But obviously, when there's new people at Apple or like guests, like presentation doing keynotes with guests and new people at Apple, in the past were not that great too. So I wouldn't say it was that bad. It was just weird, but oh well. They had to introduce it now, and they wanted to introduce it now, so that's it. I'm pretty hyped, and I will try the demo for 3 months starting June 30th. And that's it.
All right. So let's get to Apple Music.
Good. So that was it for the week. So.
No. Okay. So first of all, I'm going to talk a lot about the presentation because I find that the presentation is more worrying than the actual product they're shipping. I think that it was a disaster.
Of course.
And I think that Apple should be embarrassed of what they did, and they should never, ever, ever, ever do something like that again. Because they did a very, very terrible job of selling it. It's very comparable to the first Apple Watch presentation, I feel, where they did a very, very bad job of selling that product. They didn't really have a message that they stuck to. And I mean, there was one, but it was undermined by Jimmy Iovine not quite getting it. So Jimmy Iovine introduced the service, and I really, really like Jimmy Iovine when he has a moderator who can hold him back when he's going to start rambling about stuff that makes no sense.
Like you do?
Like me, yeah. But at the Code conference last year when they were talking about the Beats Apple acquisition, Walton Mossberg did a great job of giving a really, really great interview. And I found that that interview gave me lots of confidence in Jimmy Iovine as someone really smart who kind of gets it. The problem is that as soon as he gave that presentation about Apple Music, he sort of didn't have that leash that was holding him back, and he started rambling, and nothing got delivered very well. And the biggest sign of this is, of course, he says, it's three things. It's a revolutionary music service. And then everyone in the audience laughs because everyone at an Apple keynote has seen other Apple keynotes. And among one of them is the iPhone one.
Oh, my goodness.
And the whole point of the iPhone keynote is it's three things. It's a revolutionary internet device. It's a phone. And it's a touchscreen iPod. And they were trying to pitch the iPhone as three separate devices. And then, are you getting it? It's one device and it's called the iPhone. And then thundering applause. And that was the best moment in Steve Jobs' history. Whereas Jimmy Iovine says, it's three things. It's a revolutionary music service. Everyone starts laughing. He turns around to the slide. He's like, did something screw up on my slide? I don't get it. What's going on?
And then everybody,
like, oh, yeah.
And then everybody stops speaking in the room. Yeah, that part in the room, like, you felt the tension. It's like, oh my goodness.
Like, wow, he doesn't get it.
Exactly.
Why is he on stage? And the problem, right, is if he had been at a press event, it wouldn't have been as bad because the press is less likely to catch on to this stuff than a room of Apple developers and fans, right?
Yeah.
So
I don't know. Like,
but anyway, let's talk about those three things that Apple Music is, because I don't want to waste too much time on this.
Yeah,
but we will.
I don't want to waste too much time on the keynote. Because let's forget about the keynote. Like, it's too early.
But you can't forget about the keynote. The problem is, like, it's a first impression, and they fucked it up bad. Like, really, really, really bad.
Yeah, but they fucked it up with the watch, and the watch is a great success, and the watch is a great product, and that's it. Like,
yeah, but I still think that they got bad first impression for the Apple Watch as well.
Let me ask you one question. Do you think the service will fail because of that introduction? My answer is no.
I don't think the service will fail because of this, but I think that they have trouble communicating what the hell they're doing.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's good. So let's talk about the service now.
Right. Okay. So there's three things. There is the music streaming service where you can listen to Beats and stuff. Basically, it's Beats Music 2.0. That is all you need to know about the music service. It is a reskinned version of Beats, which I'm like, okay, but I don't care about streaming music services. Let's move on to the next thing, which is radio. They're doing a 24/7 radio station being delivered from three different studios around the world, LA, London, and
New York.
The other place, New York. And I'm very excited because the DJs that they grabbed are great people. The problem is radio sucks. And the problem with radio sucking is that it's all payola bullshit where the labels pay radio stations to play their music. And my number one concern in all of this is, well, if Apple is trying to please the music industry, is the music industry going to insist on Beats 1 being this payola bullshit station? In which case, it'll suck because it won't be any better than commercial radio. So that's one. And the second thing is right now, well, not right now because they're not at their old jobs anymore, but specifically Zanlo and Julia Nuga, who are from BBC Radio 1 and Rinse FM respectively, on their radio shows prior to this, they could play whatever the hell they wanted. They could get some random ass music from SoundCloud and play it on the radio, no problem. Is Apple going to insist that everything that they air on the radio is available globally on iTunes and or Apple Music? Because if you do that, that actually restricts your catalog quite a bit, and you can't necessarily play the best music that you want to show off to people if you have to be restricted to that catalog. So that is another concern for me as a fan of music that is not available through iTunes. Now, I'm realistic here, and I know that they're not going to be playing fucking anime songs on Beats 1, right? I know that.
I hope you know that, because not going to happen. Not going to happen.
I know that. But on the other hand, there's just very interesting electronic music stuff on SoundCloud in general that is not necessarily stuff that is on major labels or anything, and or not being distributed on iTunes. And specifically for Julianne Nuga, which I think is, well, she is the youngest, so she's the most in tune to this. I'm concerned that they're going to find it limiting within the Beats 1 system if they have this restriction for everything needs to be on Apple Music or iTunes for it to be relevant, right? Because you don't want to be playing music on the radio that is owned by Apple Music and then have people say, hey, I want that song, and then, well, sorry, it won't be on sale on Apple Music or streamable. You're like, hmm. So that's my issue with radio. My other issue, my last issue with radio is, do young people even care about radio anymore? And I don't think they do.
I don't think they care. And I know that both of us don't care about radio. But
well,
I care more. Okay. But
I actually do care because, like, as someone who does DJing on the side, I believe this thing about when Jimmy Iovine talks about human curation and that the song that follows next matters. Like, yes, that is the job of a good DJ. Now, I have less confidence in the playlist curation side of things than I do in the radio curation times of things, because they are more flexible on the radio because it's not just a list of tracks, right? But, like, I don't think, like, my brother or anyone in that age range, a generation below us, actually gives a fuck.
You know what? If they're able to have not traditional radio on the internet and have their own new way of doing radio, like, don't forget, it's like 24/7 globally. Everybody's listening at the same time.
Wait.
Same shit at the same time.
I have to bring up something from the keynote again. They had the demo reel where they were playing a clip of what was going to be a representative of what Beats 1 sounded like. And they didn't play a single song in the entire thing. It was just Beats 1, always on, 24/7, London, LA, New York. And it was just that bullshit with the sound of typical commercial radio in the background. That gives me zero confidence that they are actually going to sound distinct.
Speaking of which, I think you should do those voices for radio.
Always on, 24/7, limitless possibility, FM.
Oh my goodness. I think we found our new opening. We don't have an opening, so we have a new one now. Oh, well, okay.
That's going to sound great through a compressor.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Anyway, let's stop rambling about radio unless you have anything left to say.
The only thing I wanted to say at last was, remember when they announced that, I was like, surprised and really like, it felt to me surprising that they were able to do that. And the first thing you told me was, you know, like global radio already exists. I was like, yeah, but this feels different. And I know they did a bad job of telling us why it feels different, but I was in the room listening to that and it felt different. Like it felt futuristic, like that I could be working, listening to Beats 1, and somebody at the other corner of the world is listening to Zane Lowe at the same time as me, listening to the same music or maybe introducing that new artist that he found like somewhere.
They said the exact same thing when they launched iTunes 1 in like 2001, because you could listen to any major radio station in the United States via iTunes. It's the same thing, except that now, instead of having one studio in New York, it's a studio in New York, one in LA, and one in London. I don't see the big deal. It's just streaming online radio. And it's always been global because the internet is global, so I don't see what the big deal is.
No, I know, but you know what? My technical brain is like thinking that, but my emotional music brain is kind of like, not tease, but like it's like in awe in front of that. Like this big corporation is still seeing value in doing global radio.
It's trying to bring the world together as a music community that is united across the world. And whether or not, I mean, like the thing is, that is what they're trying to do. I just don't think that that's any different from what anyone else is doing on the internet, except they're just not doing it through radio. Like SoundCloud makes me much more connected to the rest of the world of music, and that's not radio. That's just literally a list of songs on a page that people have uploaded themselves, and I can listen to stuff that people have made in their bedrooms. People can listen to shit I make.
No, I know, I know.
Like in my room all the time.
I know, and I know there's no difference between Beats 1 as an internet radio and any other service of internet radio, but maybe what I like about it and what it like what my music taste or my music emotion sense is liking about that is just not political, but maybe the that sense of bringing everyone together as a whole that just like it feels magic. So that's it. That's the word. It feels okay, so magic. When it might not be. Let's be honest, it might not be.
Yeah, well, speaking of bringing people together, let's talk about Connect, which is basically the third pillar of this Apple Music service, which is basically
Bing 2.0.
Twitter for music. Yeah, no, the thing is, like, a lot of people give Ping shit, and I know it's easy to give Ping shit because it failed. But the problem is, the exciting part of Ping was not the part that isn't Connect. The part that was exciting in Ping is, hey, my friend bought music. He has similar tastes to me. Maybe I should go check that artist out. What they did instead is the opposite thing, which is they made Twitter for musical artists. And the problem is they're already on Twitter, so why the fuck are you bothering?
No, exactly. Like, you're right that the Ping feature that was pretty nice is kind of why I use Last.fm. Like, that feature was in Ping and nobody cared about it. Like, in a way, Nobody cares about Last.fm. Oh, wait.
And related to the bitching on iTunes Ping is everyone bitches all the time about app discovery on the App Store. In fact, we did it earlier when we were talking about search.
You did.
I did. The solution that people have been asking for years for app discovery is let me see the apps that my friends buy. And of course, there are privacy concerns because if you buy Grindr on your iPhone and you're not out to your family, well, maybe they don't necessarily want to find out from your iTunes Ping timeline, right?
Speaking about personal experience here?
No.
I love that you use Grindr as an example, but okay.
Well, it's something that you might not want your family to find out about.
No, you're right. I guess you can just say that you have it installed like, Guy English, just to see the UI.
No, I don't even have it installed for that. Sorry. But so iTunes Ping, if they had actually spread that service out to apps, it would have been a much bigger success than if they had limited themselves to music the whole time, which is what they did. So now they just have this like weird Twitter thing for Apple Music, It's free to read the content that is there. But if the artists post music or video to the service, you have to actually pay for it. But the question is, who the hell is going to post stuff exclusively for Apple Music when it is not in their interest to do so, because they can post it to Twitter and Facebook and get a lot more exposure, and ultimately that is what they are seeking, because they are trying to make music off their goddamn album.
You know what? Like, something that was really funny related to all of that, like, social connect shit, and also all related to the Apple Music service, is the elephant in the room was Taylor Swift, you know? Like, nobody mentioned what's going on with her and that service, if she's going to allow it or not. And some artists that they are trying to achieve the same goal as her. So maybe, like, they'll be able to just create a community for them while using Connect. But at the same time, you're right that they could do that on their own without giving any money to Apple.
One other thing I find concerning about Connect is during one of the intro videos, Trent Reznor was talking about how Connect really puts a mainstream artist on equal footing with someone in their bedroom who is producing music. And the problem is, right now, if you go and try to sign up for Connect as an artist, they tell you to go through your music label, which completely contradicts what he just said in that intro video, and just leads me to believe that people are going to continue to be using SoundCloud despite how bad the spam issues are there, because that's where the people are. And there was one other thing that I wanted to say, but...
Yeah, that was... Speaking of that label, going through your label thing, can you imagine, like, if they started to do, like, going... If you want to publish app on the App Store, you need to go to your distributor. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and the problem is, like, I know that in the business, if they want to attract the big artists and the big labels, they need to do things that benefit those labels. The problem is that there are much more agile people who are not afraid of saying, fuck the system, like Bandcamp, who are doing incredible work. And personally, like, I bought way more music on Bandcamp last year than I've bought on iTunes ever. And that is sort of a big deal, because those artists are getting a much more significant cut of the money than I'm paying, for one, and I'm buying direct, so there's no real, I mean, like, Bandcamp is just such a great service that I think the only limitation they really have in this mobile world right now is you can't actually import that music into your music library directly on device. That is the missing piece. Because otherwise it's fantastic and I would love that.
Yeah, to be honest though, I don't face those same problems, because I, like, don't take it...
You like major artists.
Okay, yeah. Don't take it personally, but, like, I have more general taste of music. Like, I don't have that much
That's fine. I mean, yeah, I'm not hating you for it. And... But I mean, like, if Apple wants to move the needle on the... on what is the best for music, and they sincerely believe that, they need to start saying, well, maybe the label system is not the best thing, and then maybe we should start doing stuff where we allowed for independent artists to distribute directly towards through us, like we do on the App Store. iTunes Connect is going to continue being shit for everyone, but at least they have some way of doing it directly to the biggest music store and music streaming service possibly in the world.
And they could make 30%
joining for an account.
And they could make 30% on every sale too.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure the music sales are going to continue to go very well after Apple Music, really, because when the biggest source of music sales suddenly says, "Hey, we're making a streaming service. Why would you buy music unless you are a DJ?" Basically.
Yeah, but I'm sure people still buy music, even though they, like, there's streaming services. So I'm sure there's still, like,
I think if you're old, you buy music. If you're young, you don't.
Okay. Yeah, I was about to go on that after my explanation, but yes, the gist of it is yes.
So that sums up more or less my negative thoughts on Apple Music. Apparently, I'm a terrible person because I dared to say these things. And a lot of people...
Whoa, I never said that.
I wasn't talking about you.
Okay.
I wasn't talking about you. But I think that there are a lot of people who, I mean, like, I think the service is probably going to be great for people who have mainstream music tastes. I'm not one of those people. So yeah, I think it's going to be great for you and normal people. I think that I have weird ass taste in music, and that when you go to Apple Music and it asks you, okay, so like the genres you like, and A, most of the genres that I identify with are not there, and B, once I select those genres that I do like that are mainstream, I don't know any of the artists that are in the little bubbles that say, okay, now choose the artists you like. That's sort of indicative that this product is not for me. The other concerning thing that I saw is the music app is significantly more messy due to all of this stuff being in the music app. Because now 4 out of 5 tabs on the bottom of the music app are reserved for functionality that is only available if you are an Apple Music user.
Yeah, it's strange. You know why? Because if you're paying for the streaming service, you do have the same feature as iTunes Match, but you can still buy iTunes Match separately.
Yeah.
Because they still give you the option. If you don't want to like opt in the streaming service, you can still buy iTunes Match for a year and still keep your old library, but with a shittier experience on your phone and your iPad.
Yeah, because now all of the functionality of the old app is buried in one tab, because it's My Music tab, and it's one tab on the tab bar. So your navigation just went completely to shit.
But maybe what they'll do is, like, remember right now they redesigned the app on the iOS 8.4 beta without showing any Apple Music related stuff. So maybe if you say, like, I don't want Apple Music, they're just like, okay, we'll flip the UI to the old new UI. And it's like, you'll get this.
At least two of those tabs aren't going away because they have functionality that's available in the free tier. Connect is not going away because you can read everything on Connect. And I absolutely want that bar to go away. And radio is still going to be available, but ad-supported. Except for Beats 1, which is apparently not ad-supported yet, ? Basically, they say there's no ads on Beats 1, and then when asked, is there any plan to eventually bring ads onto Beats 1, they say no comment.
Yeah, we don't comment on future plans.
Basically.
But I saw that you can change those tabs. Can you do the same for Connect and the radio tab? Like, could you go back to the old, more UI and change?
No.
Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, that is basically Apple Music. I think it's probably going to do okay. I don't think it's going to take over the world. I think Spotify is still going to be... I think Apple and iTunes have had such a reduction in confidence from consumers, and that now the brand that they identify with music is Spotify, and I don't think that's going to change, really.
We'll see. To be honest, we'll see. Like, I'm sure what will happen, like, for people that will pay, I'm sure that percentage will go, like, the percentage of people that will pay for music, and when I say pay for music, pay for streaming services that stream music, I'm sure they'll gain big market share on that service. But the fact that they don't have a free tier, those people will still stay on Spotify, and that market share is still really, really, really huge. And
yeah,
it's
and the problem
not,
is,
like, it's not shrinking. It's growing.
Yeah, and that's where you get into, well, the value of music has evaporated completely, and now no one wants to pay for anything, which is the same thing that happened in the App Store, which is not fun for anyone. And
no, but what I could see happening is the market share of people that will pay for streaming services grow slowly. So the current players will have to fight with each other to get those customers.
I don't think it's going to grow.
Okay, but even if it's not growing, those services will have to fight each other to get customers on board. So some customer will go from one service to another.
And but the problem is...
Yeah, but like, give me a sec.
The limiting factor is the music label.
Yeah, but give me a sec. Like... The main reason why Shopify is still going, is still like running and still having, like, I know they have tons of shit with labels because of their free tier. But the fact they still have free tier is because there's still tons of people that pay for it. And they still have that leverage on labels. But if their market, or if their ratio between free people versus paid people is growing. Like the ratio of people that are on the free side is growing compared to the people that pays. Maybe it will diminish their leverage on labels to keep their current contracts. And I could see in the future that where some people migrated their paid streaming services to Apple Music, and now the market share of Spotify on the paid user is shrinking, they lost that leverage and they won't be able to provide free, like provide the same experience for free user as they are currently providing them right now with their big paid user base. Their big, quote unquote. Like their majority of paid user in the paid paid streaming services. Because to be honest, we kind of know that they have the majority of customers that wants to pay for a streaming service. They are on Spotify.
Yeah, but I'm not sure it makes up. I'm not sure it makes up the majority of Spotify's business, though.
No, but if like obviously the big if on that if is if label still has their big leverage, like their big. Like industry of being like, label base, if they still exist in 10-15 years, maybe what I just explained will be in a greater risk to happen compared to an industry that is more indie based and they have like the same equality or justice of opportunities between somebody that's indie or doing it on its own compared to somebody that is on the label.
Okay, final point, because we really need to end this, but
yeah,
I want you to consider the way that I sort of see Spotify right now. I see them very similarly to Amazon, where they are very much willing to take a hit in order to eliminate all of their competitors.
Mm.
And the problem there is, once they've eliminated all their competitors, I don't think they will succeed necessarily, but anyway... If they do succeed to actually eliminate all of their competitors in the streaming market, which I don't think the music labels will allow, but then can they recover to make that a profitable business? And if not, and then they disappear, then where the hell does music go?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like the fact that you see Spotify the same way you see Amazon is true. Like, they're trying to, at the same time, they're trying to do the downplay the value of music. And is that a good thing? I don't know. I think it's not. But they are a major force right now, and Apple is trying, and I'm saying trying, to change that. And people in the label industry is trying to change that with Apple, as far as I know. And we'll see if it will succeed. It might succeed, and I think we're agree on that their level of success might vary, or might be way little compared to what they think right now.
And on that note, let's move on to the end of the show. Before we go into our contact information, next episode is going to be the episode where I talk about how I developed EOS. So if you have any questions, please send them to our Twitter account, which is @Limipo_podcast. And I will try to incorporate them into the next episode of the show.
Yeah. And this week's episode of Limitless Possibly was the 70th. So you can find any show notes. I don't think we'll have that much this week, but you can find them at limitlesspossibility.net/17.
You can also find the show as a whole at limitlesspossibility.net. I am @Sakurina on Twitter. That's SAKURINA. And you are?
Lukonosh, LUCCONOUCHE.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.